The next case is 98-1935, Teresa Denham v. The City of Carlisle, New Carlisle. Against Adelman
and against Johnson. Now, the question is, what's left? So if I look at the Lee and Regan case, they said I amended my pleading. So what? I don't know. So I amended my pleading. I got rid of two people. So I got one remaining party.
But you had another option, though.
Okay.
Getting the 54B language, right? I mean, is that what it was supposed to be?
It's not an option.
Okay.
It's not my option.
Did you ask?
I would stick it in there tomorrow or today before I came up here.
I didn't know if you had
I'm just crossed for delay and I'll never see you.
Did you seek it from the trial court?
The trial court not put it in just the opposite.
Exactly.
You're not even going to give it to you.
That's
so
right.
You got to come here and try this case against these two impecunious folks, spend some time up here in Clark County, and then get your verdict. Now, okay, so hold that thought. What happens if that occurred? And I said, I'm going to go through all this machination. I'm going to just take these guys to court, and we're going to do all that. Mm-hmm. We'll have a trial. Does it happen if that fall down?
Sure.
Where do they go?
Doesn't.
Where do they go? So what happens then, they say, how are you going to deal with that? Terrific, because, you know, what else? So I appeal. And I come up here, now I got a verdict against these other two, presumably. And I appeal it, and the court looks at it and says, you know,
but it depends on what district's in, because at that point, if you hadn't appealed the summary judgment in some districts, you'd have been untimely, trying to appeal it later.
That's what I meant about throwing the forward pass. I decided to run, and that's why I'm with you. And I'm trying to tell you is that I'm not doing this just because it's something to do. But we're looking at the entirety of the case, and I'm also looking at the law. And it's not like I'm asking you to do something where there's no support. There's plenty of support. And there's cases again both ways on this stuff. But the deal is to look at the 41 dismissal and say, what's the purpose of a whole dollar plan?
But a court of appeals is not bound by that language. If the court of appeals, if the trial court, for example, puts in as the final appeals order and the court of appeals looks at the text, it's not. They can send it back, but they can do the conscience. They can look at it and say, well, this is a final appeals order. It does determine the action. You can appeal it. And so the court of appeals could have rejected the court's, the trial court's determination.
Justice Douglas did that in a case where they had appeals. I forget which one. I guess the man running my party, but he said close but no cigar. In one of them, they had placed the language, but it was an improper final order.
Chef Italiano, I think.
Yeah, Chef Italiano.
Kent State.
And then the other one, that was a good appeal where they dismissed this, Kent University. He said that's a good appeal order. Except it was against all the parties 54. If you got to use the magic language, you didn't have the magic language. You're not there. You lose either way. The point being is, I don't have control of the magic language. That's the judge's discretion. But I'll tell you, in this case, there doesn't have to be the magic language because there's nothing on Judge Warren's docket. Because when we dismiss the other two defendants under Rule 41, as the Island case says, that merged with the summary judgment determination, there is a final appeal order that affects a substantial right, and that's why we're here.
How do we deal with the other side's argument that if we let these cases be appealed after voluntary dismissal, you could be in the appellate process, and then you could go back and refile against two of the parties for whatever strategic reason you choose, and now you do have piecemeal litigation. How do you respond to that? How do you deal with that issue?
What happens? Summary judgment means if it gets reversed, I get to try my case with all parties present. That's what happens. That's not piecemeal. That's all together in one time. That's what happens. That's the reality. And that's what I want, is that opportunity. I want those defendants there all together so that the jury can see what happened on that time.
Yeah, but the question is, while you're appealing the denial or the granting of the summary judgment, are you also trekking back to the courthouse and filing against the dismissed parties?
If I can, why not?
Well, I'm not arguing. I'm just saying that's the problem here.
That's the problem, is that, but that's what in my interpretation, Judge, may not, but she reports also.
Well, the answer is if it gets reversed, then you consolidate. That's really the answer.
Well, that's what I'm
oh, I understand that. Okay.
But the point being is that what I was hoping is to try it all together. In any event, the point being is 41 dismissal provides us with that opportunity. The Sixth Circuit has rendered decisions both ways, most recently saying you can do it. Courts of Appeals have split on this decision. You have the opportunity to look at 41 dismissal in light of what its intent was. There are cases, one case that's been pending for a long time, the bill, photography versus Bowers, talks about the purpose of it. And the other case that I think is really informative of the topic was the Alexander case, when it talked about what Rule 41 of 54B talked about as a procedural rule, but more importantly, it talked about the policy behind this, and the idea is to do justice, and I can't believe that it would be justice to have required counsel to pursue a case, get a verdict, hang it up on the wall like a Hoover vacuum warranty because you can't get the funds for the party. It's a futile and vain act when you have an opportunity to pursue a party that is a legitimate party in the case, who wouldn't have them, and to bring them all before the court, all before the jury, all at one time.
If you were to dismiss these defendants with prejudice, a final, in as much as they're not, as you say, legitimate defendants.
I didn't say that, ma'am.
Oh.
No, I did not. I said impecunious.
Well, you said the real legitimate defendant would be the city. Yeah, okay.
I apologize. I did not mean that at all. No, each one of these, Mark Adelman has an interesting record in that bar. I have never seen so many times when police officers have visited a bar, not to purchase a beer, but to remove folks, and it was finally closed down. Mr. Johnson struck.
You want those defendants in there,
absolutely.
I see.
Mm-hmm. I'm not doing this. I
figured as much.
No, and I'm sorry, and I'm glad you brought up that point. I might have some time for rebuttal.
Well, your white light is not on yet, so you have at least 2 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Bellotto.
Good faith belief now that B and C are no longer liable, but under your theory,
either violates Rule 11, which is PDSP or C, or he loses out on any. Correct? No. What he needs to do is complete the discovery and find out where claims stand against DNC. No right in the appeal is being jeopardized by completing discovery. If it's about a client's best interest, they can't afford all that extra discovery. They can't afford all those expert witnesses. And that's not in the client's best interest. Are you in the hospital for instance? No, but that's just a matter of litigation. Whether or not the plaintiffs can afford the litigation really is a consideration that's taken into account by the procedure rules that were given to manage the litigation. In effect, the plaintiffs have another choice. The plaintiff's bar has, or the plaintiff in this action, has an opportunity to defend the two defendants with prejudice and then proceed directly to the appeal, because the dismissal with prejudice does not dissolve the order. It does not divest the trial court jurisdiction to proceed and hear the appeal. It does not divest the trial court to receive that dismissal.
But a dismissal without prejudice doesn't do that either, does it? Making it with prejudice or without prejudice doesn't change the summary judgment order, does it? The status of it?
I believe that the courts have consistently held that a dismissal without prejudice of an action, as allowed by Rule 41A, dissolves any orders that are in existence and divest the trial court of jurisdiction. It's over.
Now here the plaintiff dismissed parties. I suppose arguably the action against certain parties, but did not dismiss the action, did he?
Yes, the action was dismissed. Rule 41 specifically uses the term action. Other places in case law and procedure rules, the term claim is used. The claim isn't used in 41A. So when the voluntary dismissals were filed against defendants B and C, and defendant A, my client, the village of New Carlisle, had already obtained dismissal for summary judgment, the case was over.
That's a good point, and I was trying to trace it through to go backwards. Let's start with just what happened here, or in any case like we've all had where you dismiss one party because you think now you've got everything clear to the trial court. We've always said if there's nothing pending the trial court, you can chogi up to the Court of Appeals. And that's just our general rule, isn't it?
Just to send parties up to the Court of Appeals?
No. You go to the Court of Appeals after there's nothing pending in the trial court anymore.
Yes.
Okay. What happens if this case is affirmed on the split of the authority? Instead of us filing the 8th District, we follow the, whatever it is, the 2nd District here, the 2nd District. Isn't it res judicata vis-a-vis your client?
Your Honor,
it's an important question to me because now you have no appellate rights at all.
Well, I don't believe that it would operate as res judicata. I believe that the voluntary dismissal applies to all parties within that action.
So what you're saying is, even if we affirm, you're prepared to go back and let him start all over against the same parties, same thing all over again. Your summary judgment is for naught.
That's correct. We will start all over again.
And you think that's the right result?
It's not a bad result. There are many things negative to it. The work that has been accomplished in that case can be used.
Okay, sure. And what is the factual that you'd get up and say, why are we here? We got summary judgment the first time around. I can hear Mr. Friend saying that. He said it to me before. Why are we here? We've already got summary judgment. It's clearly res judicata. Oh, it isn't? Well, then, it's persuasive. We've already won once. How many times do we have to go through this? Isn't that what's going to happen?
It is going to happen.
Okay.
We're going to go back down to the trial court and we're going to start again. But the fact of the matter is, the plaintiffs in this case is that we'll still have an opportunity to challenge, should we obtain summary judgment again, we'll still have an opportunity to challenge that decision. And I'd like to call the court.
One more question, then I'll stop. What about a statute of limitations at that point? Once the case is dismissed per 41, and what if the original statute of limitations had run against your client? Because we don't have a dismissal with regard to your client. We have a summary judgment.
The summary judgment, according to the case law that we're relying on, The order granting a summary judgment was resolved in the 41A dismissal trial.
All right. But they still only have a set period of time to bring a cause of action against your client, 2 years. Now, suppose after all of this is done, they dismiss. Would you say they have the savings clause of a year?
From the point of the voluntary?
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So you keep your client exposed during this entire period of time?
Yes.
And the other, I guess the other sort of a follow-up question, I guess, to that is that it would seem to me that we, if we can under the rule, it would seem to me that we would encourage plaintiffs to dismiss defendants where they feel there's no action against them, unless it's some strategic, but I don't think we can determine that. But why would we encourage, and Mr. Deutsch's alternative here, I guess, is to leave the defendants in the case who he thinks should have been dismissed. Probably at some expense to them, certainly some concern to them. That do we want to do that? Is that a good result?
I'm not sure that I understand your question.
Well, if he had not dismissed the defendants that he dismissed, then I guess maybe I'm wrong, but I guess then the action we wouldn't have this claim that the action was dismissed, right? And we have the summary judgment. He wants to appeal it. He dismisses a couple of more defendants, and now we say the case has been the action's been dismissed. The alternative for him, I guess, for somebody in that position would be, well, I don't want that result, so I'll just leave these two defendants as defendants, even though I think I don't have any action against them. And then try to get 54B language, I suppose, and be able to appeal.
Right.
Is that a result we want? That's not economy of process, is it?
Well, I think Mr. George addressed this issue. I don't think he dismissed the other two defendants because he didn't think he had a case against them. I think he dismissed them because he wants to go after my client and have to be talked.
Well, that's what he says, but we write law for all the cases that come, after this one. And if we write the law as you're suggesting, it seems to me we discourage the dismissal of defendants who really ought to be dismissed, as well as some who probably shouldn't be, but that's what happens.
Right, I would respectfully disagree. I don't think that is the message that the court would be sending to the bar. I think the message that would be sent by affirming the Second District opinion in Boucher is that the trial courts are in control of the litigation process, and the trial court is impartial and in the best position to decide when a case is ripe for appeal. Even though we don't see it often, I myself have never seen it. It is in Rule 54B. The trial courts can go back and revise an interlocutory decision.
Okay, on that issue, I didn't ask my other question very well. Now I have it. No. But I vote.
Oh, Your Honor, I didn't mean to be disrespectful.
So far.
But
it might even have helped you.
I do apologize. What we see when we look at the rules developed in the 8th District, the guideline that was developed, is that they took a look at Rule 41, and they made a distinction in Part 3 of that rule and said, you know, we are not going to dismiss, we are going to allow remaining defendants to dismiss claims of parties. And that is as if they never existed before. And they overlooked the rule action in 41A. The case law relied upon by the 8th District are cases decided before 1970, before July of 1970, which is the enactment of the civil rule. And they didn't contemplate what the civil rule would tell us. And I think that is telling of what they are trying to accomplish. I think the decision that was reached in the Eland Court did not squarely address 41A, but tried to circumvent it in order to create a process to allow cases to immediately go up. And they went so far as to say, after you voluntarily dismiss your main defendants or main claims, you must seek 54B language from the trial court. It has to appear on a piece of paper, and then you will accept it. If you don't, you will soon finally dismiss it. So, the consideration to be taken into account stems from the language that is in 41A and also echoes in 2505.2. And that language clearly states that it will the order with respect to parental rights must in effect determine an action and prevent a judgment, not by obtaining an order, giving it immunity in the summary judgment order, does not prevent a judgment and does not affect a potential right with regard to sentence B and C in the case.
Counsel, when you look at the whole picture of what's presented here, it seems to me that we enforce these things. These rules are designed to avoid piecemeal appeals. But we also don't like piecemeal litigation. And there's a train back here between those. You're going to all of them have one or the other, aren't you? And which should prevail overall in terms of the bigger picture, the administration of justice?
I think
which should be trump card.
Looking at the big picture, I think the key is to ensure that our trial judges stay in control of litigation. I think that is the most impartial and fair way to do it. Because if you have B and C who are dismissed, say not like this case, say you have three defendants that all have B comments, and you have B and C and they're dismissed, and discovery stops in that case. When discovery starts up again, if they are then brought in after the appeal starts, or say, as the appeal is going on defendant A's summary judgment motion, plaintiff reinstitutes the causes of action against B and C, and then approaches the trial judge and says, Judge, I don't want to have to try this case twice. Why don't you just stay this action down here in the trial court, and then when my appeal is finished up here, we'll bring it back down and I'll try them all together. Well, B and C are waiting down here. They're exposed to liability down here in the trial court while defendant A is up here appealing. And discovery could be had as time passes. People's memory becomes more foggy as time passes. Maybe evidence is lost or destroyed. And memory is had without a key party who then comes back into the case after the appeal is over and says, well, I never got to participate in any depositions and I never got to participate in any of this discovery, so we've got to repeat it all because I'm in the case now. And so there, I mean, I did that all the time in the trial, which state action, so there's a piece of it that went up and we didn't want to have to come back and repeat and duplicate everything because we now got another party back in. When you talk about balance of equity, which is equity in favor of full access to the courts by the attorney's office, I don't think it's really going to be denied full access to the court. In some cases, discovery may have to be repeated. I would be silly to tell you otherwise. Obviously, sometimes discovery will have to be repeated, but the trial judge will be best positioned to evaluate the case and to decide in each particular case, given the type.